All right, we are in John chapter 11. John chapter 11. We actually got through, I think, 37 verses last week, which is probably a record. So we're somewhere around verse 38 of John chapter 11. So Jesus, again, being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. Jesus said, "Remove the stone." Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they removed the stone. Then Jesus raised his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said it so that they may believe that you sent me." When he said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." The man who had died came forth bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face was wrapped around with a cloth. Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." Therefore many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. So we recall from last week the situation here, Jesus delaying coming, the disappointment on the part of the family, the fact that the Jews, as we saw in verse 37, but some of them said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind have kept this man also from dying?" Even though in that statement you'll notice they don't say, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also raise him to life?" Because again, the Jewish expectation was the resurrection at the eschaton, at the final day. So it would be more healing of sickness than it would be conquering of death in resurrection. That's not what they are expecting. And as they go to the tomb, they are not going, "Oh, we're going to see a resurrection." That's not the kind of expectation that is theirs. So when they come to the tomb, and this does seem to fit with what we know historically about Jewish burial practices in the first century. You would have a sepulcher, a tomb, a cave, a stone lying against it, just as Jesus's would be in the not too distant future at this point. And generally, the practice was to leave the dead there for about a year. And then once the natural decaying process has taken place, those bones would be gathered and placed into a bone box. And many, many, many of these have been found. You may recall the Talpiot tomb story of a couple years ago, where James Cameron and some others tried to make hay and money on that particular story. But at least, you know, there are warehouses filled with these ossuaries, is the technical term that is used for them, bone boxes. So the body would be laid in the sepulcher for that process to take place. And so when Jesus arrives at the tomb, he says, "Remove the stone." Yes, sir. There was a Greece in 1959? Really? Wow. That's
incredible. I was 8 years old. My mother had me attend an unearthing of someone who had died in the village. And they wanted the bones. They wanted to do special things with the bones.
Well, the Jews didn't do that. The Jews wouldn't do special things with the bones. That sounds more like in Orthodoxy, the idea of that there are in Eastern Orthodox countries and in some Roman Catholic countries, you know, entire rooms filled with bones of people who might turn out to be famous someday. The idea being that there is some kind of connection between the spiritual graces that they experienced in life and their physical bodies. And this is especially true of in religious orders. When monks and stuff like that would die, they would collect the bones, and there's rooms where you can just go in and find the guy's skulls over here, his tibias over there, et cetera, et cetera. So if something should turn out to where he ends up being particularly holy, or you can get a good enough story going that he was, now you have relics. And it's we today just find it absolutely ghoulish, and in many ways it is. But this isn't what the Jews were doing. They would not remove the bones from the grave. They would collect the bones of the body. They would identify the person or persons. Part of it might have simply been there's only so many places to really bury people without going a long, long ways away. Remember, we can get in a car and drive out to Veterans Seminary. Veterans Cemetery, depending on which one it is. They couldn't do that. So there's only so many caves you can use, and that you can sort of, the Talpiot tomb that was unearthed had numerous antechambers with numerous bone boxes stored in one. So you could put a whole lot more people, basically, in one place than you can in the other way. So, but I don't recall in my writing of that book any references to, missing bones with the idea of some kind of sacredness. That's a pagan concept that came into early Christianity and took deep root, basically. Yeah. So when Jesus comes to the grave and says to remove the stone, there is the natural, Martha's the practical one here, says, well, Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he's been dead for 4 days. So people knew. I mean, things could happen. Maybe you open the wrong tomb, or forget which one you went to, and you roll a stone away, and blah. So people knew what the natural process was. But you'll notice something, that Jesus is again absolutely confident in this situation. He doesn't, just quietly over in a corner, while everyone else is wailing, oh Lord, please raise Lazarus from the dead and help him open the tomb. Because then if you tried that prayer and it didn't work, no one's going to know. But when you walk up the tomb and say, remove the stone, and then notice in verse 43, he cried out with a loud voice. He wasn't hiding in a corner. Because, of course, he says in verse 42, because the people standing around, I said it, they may believe that you sent me. So this is one of the signs that you have in the Gospel of John. He's not hiding anything in a corner. Martha, clearly, despite all the conversation preceding this, no one is expecting a resurrection here. This is, it's one thing for Jesus to come to the tomb and we all weep together and we all... Jesus will have some wonderful words about the coming resurrection, and he'll tell us some things about Lazarus, and he'll console us, and all will be well. Not looking for this to happen. And so when she raises the natural objection to the removal of the stone that seals the sepulcher, Jesus' response is, did I not say to you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God? And so we had sort of come to the conclusion from her words that she did not fully understand what Jesus was saying about resurrection and the life, and your brother will rise again. And she had interpreted that all within her sort of safe categories of, yes, Lord, I know he will rise in the last day, and so on and so forth. So it must have been an awkward moment when Jesus says, remove the stone, and Martha says there will be a stench, or in the classic words of the King James Version of the Bible, Lord, he stinketh. But after Jesus said this, I would assume it would have to be Mary and Martha that would give the nod. You know, it's their tomb. It's their brother. And there had to be some obedience, some act of faith here on the part of Mary and Martha to, you know, sort of look over at the guys and go, you know, okay, and do what he says. I can just imagine if it was Mary or Martha who had become some massively exalted semi-deity in Roman Catholicism, this would be the text where everybody would be looking, see, Mary and Martha agreed to what God said and made the plan, life comes through this, and blah, 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 blah. Everything that they do with the words of Mary to the angels, so let it be unto thy servants, and you know, that's how God saved the world, is with Mary's cooperation and, you know, all the rest of this stuff. So they removed the stone. I try to put myself in these situations and try to understand how a Jewish person would be responding to this. Remember, I mentioned to you last week that I think I mentioned to you last week, in fact, I'm fairly certain I mentioned to you last week, that I was listening to a debate between Marcus Borg and N.T. Wright. And Marcus Borg is a Jesus seminar, way out there liberal. Jim Renahan and I debated, he and John Dominic Crossan, on one of our cruises a number of years ago. And it was in this debate that N.T. Wright had floated the idea that Lazarus actually hadn't died. Because from Wright's understanding of what resurrection is, this couldn't have been a resurrection, because that's out of order. And so this couldn't have been a real resurrection. This was just a resuscitation. He actually hadn't really died. And it was Marcus Borg, the way out liberal, who in rather shock responded to Wright's statement by saying, but Lord, he stinketh. And it was, he was right. You know, it was one of those places where N.T. Wright just, you know, again, following his own self-understanding of his own brilliance, missed the point of the text. And so they're not expecting what's going to happen. They don't understand this. And so Jesus raised his eyes in an attitude of prayer, which you might want to remember this every time a Muslim comes along and tells you that Jesus prayed just like they do, with his head bowed to the earth. Well, he might have done that in the garden once, but here he prays, raising his eyes to heaven, which no Muslim's going to do. Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but because of the people standing around, I said so that they may believe that you sent me. So Jesus prays, and he affirms the perfect communion and communication that exists between himself and the Father, and the fact that he is doing this so that the people standing around, those who are witnesses to this event, may believe that you sent me. There is revelatory value in regards to who Jesus is in this event. Now, we might stop for just a moment and point out that while there is, you know, to an enlightened mind, to a mind that has been redeemed, what happens here is very straightforward, very clear as to its testimony to who Jesus is. But notice, there is, as always, a division in the response to what takes place. You will notice that many people believe. Others went off and told the Pharisees what happened, and they start plotting the destruction of Jesus. So just because there is a revelation that is meant to bring salvation does not mean that every single person who sees it is going to respond in a salvifically appropriate way. This we see many, many times, both in the Old and the New Testaments. So when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. So he's committed here. Can you imagine any scenario other than the one that we have taking place here? In other words, I mentioned last week, the woman I'll never ever forget, we used to have a Saturday radio program before we discovered that no one listens to radio on Saturday. And we had this woman call in, and we were talking about the doctrines of grace and the sovereignty of God and salvation and all the rest of these things. And I brought up this incident. I said, well, let me see if I understand what you're saying about your understanding of free will. Is it your understanding that Jesus could have said, Lazarus, come forth, and Lazarus stayed in the tomb? You know, I jokingly said, a voice comes forth from the tomb. Thanks. No thanks. You don't know what it's like to live with those sisters, and just stays there, or just somehow have the ability to resist this divine power, that is intended by God to be a demonstration of who Jesus is. But you see, that's the problem. That's the whole difference between man-centered salvation and God-centered salvation, is if you think of it in a man-centered way, what God is intending to do in showing his own glory is irrelevant. It's what I decide that matters. And if I decide not to get saved, then there's nothing God can do about it, is basically the idea that people have. And so, how long will there be God tube in heaven so we get to go back and watch any of this, rewind it back and time? I mean, when Jesus says, Lazarus, come forth, is it immediately, poof, he's all of a sudden, here comes this guy. Can you imagine what it was like? I mean, we've seen movies with, zombies or mummies or whatever it is, coming out of the grave. And, did people scream? Was there, we're not told. We don't know how long it was. But I can guarantee you, however long it was, because, Lazarus is not going to be sprinting here. The man who had died came forth bound hand and foot with wrappings. He is not sprinting. So I would imagine there had to have been some brief period of time where everyone is just standing with their mouths hanging open, staring at the opening of that cave, going, he didn't just say, Lazarus, come forth, did he? Were some people thinking, does he just not know he's dead? The thoughts would have been manifold. Many different thoughts would have been going on. So at some point, the man who died came forth bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face is wrapped around with a cloth. That's another good reason for him not to be sprinting. I can just see Lazarus raised from the dead, runs into the wall, knocks himself silly, and that's the end of that. So that would have been, roll the stone back, and it would have been a whole different thing. Yes, sir. No earthly idea. That's one of the things that Wright has a real problem with, is he can't understand how there could be a resurrection that did not result in eternal life in the person resurrected, in the sense of from that point forward. So from his perspective, if Lazarus was really raised from the dead, then he would still be living in Bethany and would have lots of property now. As would the widow's son. So each one of these situations are resurrections where there is a return to life, but it is not a granting of continuity of life for the rest of eternity. So there's a difference at that particular point. Now, Lazarus, we would assume, is a believer and will receive his body back at the resurrection just like all the rest of us will. So Lazarus gets to go through that twice. Yeehaw. But obviously for him, that would have been a great honor to be one of the only one that we know. I mean, the widow's son from Nain. Now, how would you like to be stuck with that the rest of your life? We know one name, and that's Lazarus. Can you imagine what it would be like to be Lazarus from this point onward? Have you ever thought about that? I mean, what was it like to walk down the road the next week? you know, and walk up to a, you know, you bought your food in the market. So, you know, Lazarus walks up to buy his kosher fish, you know, and I'd like to have two of those. You can just have them, sir. You know, and people walking by, you know, or people going by, going. Hey, Lazarus, great funeral, you know. I mean, you really, it really does make you sort of sit back and go, wow, what was it like? And when persecution breaks forth against the Christians, I mean, his is not a name that allows you to hide real easy, you know. You know, we don't know. We don't know. It would be fascinating to know. Did he live a regular time period after? I would assume so. Yeah. Yes. That's true. Yeah. There have to have been a time or two where you thought, wow, this has introduced some whole new complexities to my life. Because, yeah, he was a walking, talking testimony to the fact the Pharisees were wrong about Jesus. Oh, yeah, that's... Just about, yeah. So, Jesus says to them, unbind him and let him go. Now, who was the first one to volunteer to do that? You know, the same guys that opened the tomb, you know, the guys with the strong noses, I don't know. Or was it finally Mary and Martha who moved and, boom, you know, right over to him? And when they first, you know, it says his face was wrapped around the cloth, you know, what was that meeting like? I mean, this would make incredible film, you know. I imagine it's in the Jesus movie somewhere. I've never seen it, but... therefore, many of the Jews who came to Mary, many of the Jews who came to Mary and saw what he had done believed in him. And so they're like, yeah, all right. Now the problem is, that's the same form that's used in John 8 about non-saving faith. So it's not really a commentary as to whether this is saving faith from what they saw. But it's contrasting that with verse 46, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them the things which Jesus had done. Now, do we automatically assume these were type people? Well, some obviously were. Were others just so confused they went to the only religious leaders they knew for an answer about what this is all about? We've heard that our religious leaders say this man's a charlatan, he's a fraud. What we just saw has left us completely in the dark. How do we understand this? Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, what are we doing? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Now, here are the words of the religious political. Or the political religious. This is what happens when political power and religious power become intermingled in the same hands. And we've seen the history of this in Western Christendom. You know, when you can have someone who is so perverted by their traditions and their false religion and their political power that, you know, the priest stands next to the person on the rack and cranks it a few more times and they're screaming and you're going, oh, well, this is for your own good, you know, that kind of perversion of thought. And here you have the perversion of thought that, not that here is a man who can give life and raise the dead and only Yahweh can give life and therefore this man must be from God. Nah, none of that. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe him. The Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. They're more concerned about the Romans than they are God. They may be as religious as the day is long, but they're almost atheistic functionally. They don't care about God's purposes or anything like that. They're concerned about our place and our nation. And they're concerned about the most powerful force on earth from their perspective, and that's the Roman Empire. The religio-political corruption that is so very, very common. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, now I need to just mention very briefly, because you'll hear this all the time. I know one Harvard grad who's become a Muslim who uses this as an example of how worthless John is as a gospel. See, John was written so late that he doesn't even realize there is only one high priest a year. Well, I think John knew that there was only one high priest per, in a lifetime, actually. He thinks there's one high priest per year. But it says one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, the problem is the Romans have gotten involved. And the Romans recognized the high priesthood was a political situation. Therefore, they had violated the Mosaic laws, had removed Caiaphas' father-in-law, Annas, as I recall, from the position and put Caiaphas in. But hey, if Caiaphas didn't do what they wanted to do, they could undo that too. And so that's what John is reflecting. At that particular time, Caiaphas is the high priest. He says to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people and that the whole nation not perish. Now, he did not say this on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the scattered children of God who are scattered abroad. So from that day on, they planned together to kill Jesus. Therefore, Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to the country near the wilderness in a city called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. Now, here you have a very, very interesting section where you have Caiaphas, who in essence is saying, don't you realize that it is better for us to sacrifice one man for the people, the whole nation, not perish? And that sounds so wonderfully patriotic and all the rest of this stuff. But this is a man who is promoting the idea of using, by hook or by crook, some means of bringing about the death of Jesus because of what he's done. And the most perverse men can sound quite sane and quite accurate in what they're saying. And here you have one who is speaking very perversely in light of what he wants to do, his own desires. Yet, in the perversity of his speech, John tells us there is an activity of God. The high priest is speaking here. And you may recall that even when Paul's brought before the high priest and he rebukes him, and then he's struck, and then he said, well, you're not supposed to rebuke the high priest of your people. And there's supposed to be respect given to this person's office, despite the fact that he himself is grossly perverse. But being high priest that year, he prophesied. He wasn't trying to. And in fact, what he says is the exact opposite of what he would want the reality to be. But he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but in order that he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So here you have a theological reflection on John's part on the words of the high priest. How John came to know this, well, obviously supernatural revelation is a possibility, but it's also quite possible that given how many priests and Pharisees and scribes became Christians in the early church, that there were many men at that meeting who eventually became believers and then later testified about what had taken place that time. And they remembered, you know, Caiaphas said, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people and that the whole nation not perish. And evidently they saw in those words this idea of the whole nation, all the children of God, not just the Jewish people, but as they saw the gospel go forth to the Gentiles, here is a prophecy that Jesus' death brings about the means by which he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. And so this same theme, I think, is what we pick up in Revelation chapter 5 when you have the song that is sung there. It says, Lamb, how he by his death has redeemed men from every tribe, tongue, people, and nation, made them a kingdom of priests unto God. By his death, the very same concept that is found here, that by his self-sacrifice, he might also gather together into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. That is the means by which the unity of that body comes together. So from that day on, they planned together to kill him. And that plot will eventually lead them to Judas. Therefore, Jesus no longer continued to walk publicly among the Jews, but went away from there to the country near the wilderness. This really is pretty much the primary ending of Jesus' public ministry. In chapter 12, there's going to still be some things. The Greeks come. But chapter 12 really wraps it up. Chapter 13 then begins the private ministry to the disciples that goes through chapter 17. Now, the Passover of the Jews is near, and many went up to Jerusalem out of the country before the Passover to purify themselves. So they were seeking Jesus and saying to one another as they stood in the temple, what do you think, that he will come to the feast at all? Now, the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was to report it so that they might seize him. And so you have the plot is put forth. Clearly there are people amongst the Jews that are aware of what the plot is, and this is going to lead eventually in God's providence to the arrest of Jesus and the crucifixion and everything that takes place at that particular point in time. Now, just briefly, because I don't want to go back to the synoptics, we'll go back there, not next week, but the week thereafter. And pick up where they just sort of inserted John chapter 11 out of thin air. We can tell by this that we are getting very close to the crucifixion week, and that's going to be. I never intended 7 some odd years ago. If that's how long ago we is that how long ago it was?
8 years,
2 months. So in 2002, wow, August of 2002, okay, well, one of the problems in having a study last that long is that much of the foundational material that we laid back then is now ancient history for all of us, and some of you weren't here in 2002 or 2003 and so on and so forth. And those who were might not just have everything right at the tip of your tongue from every Bible study lesson that you have ever heard at that point in time. So we're coming to the material that is actually contains most of the most difficult and challenging synoptic parallel issues. And so I have a feeling that at some point, as we really start delving into those things, we may have to do a little remedial 101 review of some of the fundamental issues that we face when we're comparing texts with other texts. I know that one of the next sections we're going to hit, at least as I was looking at the numbers in my computer, that seemed to be the case. Yes, 264, the healing of the blind man, Bartimaeus in section 264 in the synopsis. That's coming up real quickly. That'll immediately force us back into reviewing some of the fundamentals of how to deal with synoptic issues, and that is telescoping, looking at the audience that each is intending. The Bartimaeus one introduces us to issues of going into Jericho, coming out of Jericho. One gospel only mentions one person, gives his name, Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, I believe, as I recall. And another gospel just says two blind men. And it's very, very common for people to say, well, was it one or is it two? See, the Bible doesn't even know, you know. And these are simplistic arguments that are inconsistent. I mean, if every gospel just read the exact same way, the immediate response would be, ah, see, they're just copying each other. There's no independent witnesses here. You wouldn't have independent people coming up with this thing. You know, but then when they do have a difference, one focuses upon only one person who was known to them, Bartimaeus, they give a name. Somebody else says, well, there's actually two of them there. The other guy didn't say anything, but there's two of them there. Ah, see, they don't know what they're talking about. You know, the inconsistencies are great in that kind of stuff. But again, it will remind us of those issues. We're going to have to sort of go back over them. And especially when we get into post-resurrection appearances and stuff like that, there have been many Christian theologians that have put their hands up in the air and said, there is no way to harmonize any of that. We just don't know. And so it'll be challenging. And the only way to do that is to really have a good foundation going in. So that's what we'll be doing when we get to that material. Okay? All right. Let's close the time with a word of prayer. Our gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for the reminder that our Lord Jesus Christ is Lord over all things, that he is the giver of life, and indeed that relationship that he had with you was perfect, one of perfect harmony, that you always heard him, because he always did what was pleasing to you. We have life because of that. Help us to rejoice in that this day. Be with us as we go into worship now. Lift up our hearts and our minds that we might understand your truth and bring honor and glory to you. We pray in Christ's name.